Welcome to the Weekend Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. This episode is brought to you by NetSuite and by 8Sleep, the ultimate sleep machine. We'll hear more from them later. Joined by Sarah Longwell and Andrew Egger in our DC studios. So thanks for coming in. Appreciate it very much.
Hey, Charlie.
How's it going, Charlie?
Well, I want to talk about Bob Mueller. I want to talk about The Hangover. And, you know, it is, you know, interesting how many people have used the term hangover to describe that. I think that it's usually a metaphor. It feels literal. Like we're all a little bit hungover about it. So, yes.
Well, here's the thing about that is you only get hungover if you overextend yourself the day prior. I woke up the day after the Mueller testimony, feeling fine, feeling fresh, because I didn't expect it to be, you know, the world's most earth-shattering piece of testimony ever, and then it wasn't. So I felt okay. I mean, not to flex on all of Media America in doing that, but yeah. I mean,
I woke up the day after the Mueller testimony, opened my eyes, and first thing that came to my mind was, what fresh hellscape are we in now? So just Sarah, you're in the middle here.
No, I agree with you. I'm totally hungover by it, and it's because it's not because of, you know, it was so taxing to sit through the Mueller hearing, but because watching everybody react to it is thoroughly depressing when you realize just what unserious people we are. Robert Mueller is a serious man living in unserious times, and we don't deserve him. And he did his best to come in and be a neutral civil servant, and he was met by a bunch of people whose goal was to make, you know, all the facts suspect, to make institutions untrustworthy, and in the process make it so that truth really can't exist. And so ultimately it all came down to optics. And so the analysis, the post game, is just optics, optics, optics. And I think you made this point today in your newsletter this morning, Charlie.
I beat up on myself, yeah.
So it's totally right, because we do. We all sit around being like, well, how did it look? And I think at the end of the day, the question is, you know, Robert Mueller and 13 people spent years carefully documenting a case in a 430-page report. And the fact that nobody bothered to read it, and that we all demanded this this you know, blockbuster movie to be the result. And when we didn't get it, everybody's upset that he wasn't, he wasn't cutting a more, a tougher version of himself. Just to me, it makes me sad, not about him, but about us.
Okay, I'm going to come back to this in a little while, because I agree with you completely here, but I want what Andrew is smoking. I just we could do the, well, we could do, well, we could do okay. This off the air. We can do this off the air. Okay, I want to just jump ahead a little bit, because there are these genuine massive outrages which I think are not necessarily completely obvious in terms of explanation. So we have the Mueller testimony, and one of the I don't think it's a controversial takeaway to say that he doubled down in his warnings about the Russian interference in our elections and the fact that it was an ongoing attack. And then you had the Senate Intelligence Committee come out with this very detailed report suggesting that the Russians had targeted all 50 states, which confirms everything we've been hearing from the FBI, from the national intelligence agencies. And then what do Republicans in the Senate do? They block multiple times action on any legislation that would actually defend the country. Let me just call this up, because this is not necessarily self-evidently obvious why they're doing it. Okay, McConnell blocks two bills on election security on the eve of on the heels of the Mueller warning. One day after former special counsel Robert Mueller issued a stark warning that the Russians are actively seeking to interfere once again in the U.S. elections and called for aggressive deterrence measures, Senate Democrats sought passage of multiple election security bills, only to be stopped by Republican leader Mitch McConnell for the second time this week. Chuck Schumer accused Republicans of putting their head in the sand. Mueller's testimony was a clarion call for election security, Schumer said, blah, 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 blah. So what is my... But McConnell said the Democrats are just trying to make political hay on the heels of the Mueller testimony in their attempt to bring up a House bill that would mandate the use of paper ballots in state election systems and provide additional funding to the Federal Nonpartisan Election Assistance Commission. This is partisan legislation for the Democratic House of Representatives. Okay, blah, 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 blah. You know all this. See, what I don't understand is, isn't the obvious political play for Trump and the Republicans to say, okay, yeah, whatever happened here, we're on board with protecting the country, defending the nation against this attack. Everybody's in favor of election integrity. Obviously, we want to make sure that we are prepared. So why not?
I sort of think there are two things going on here, Charlie. And one is just, you know, the more structural problem that you know, Mitch McConnell is pretty much the tightest fisted Senate majority leader we've seen in a while. I mean, I saw a headline yesterday that just crunched the numbers and found that it was easier for even for GOP senators to, you know, get votes on their on bills or amendments that they wanted on the floor under Harry Reid than it has been under McConnell, just because he is such a miser when it comes to what he will even allow votes on.
Right. And why draw the line on this?
Well, right. And the other thing is just that, you know, as you say, it's true that one would think that would be sort of the correct strategic move for Trump and Republicans to telegraph that they are taking this Russia stuff seriously, that you know, they don't want this sort of meddling to happen again. But the reality of the situation is that has, you know, ostensibly been the strategic move for years now. And it's just apparently the case that in Donald Trump's Republican Party that he pushes away anything that has to do with Russia, just because it sort of triggers him to hear about how Russian interference might have helped him, even in small ways.
Right. This is the heart of it, though, isn't it, Sarah? This comes down to that Donald Trump himself just is so obsessively opposed to highlighting Russian interference, and nobody in this party, in Congress, even the ones who understand the severity of the problem, want to tick him off. I mean, this is all about not pissing off Donald Trump, isn't it?
That's absolutely right. I mean, that Trump does not want anyone to suggest at all that he might be an illegitimate president or that he was helped by Russia. And that is why Mitch McConnell doesn't want to poke the bear by having there be bills moving on election security. But what's crazy is that there are a bunch of Republicans on these Senate bills. There are multiple Senate bills. I mean, Marco Rubio's got the Deter Act. Lankford's got a bill. Lindsey Graham has a bill. And so none of them, and McConnell has come out more than once to say, I'm absolutely not moving these, no matter whether his own intelligence community or his own intelligence committee says, hey, they're actively continuing to try to interfere in the election. And in normal political times, this would be sort of political constitutional malpractice. But again, because we don't live in normal times, nobody's going to do anything.
Okay,
about
so this is a very, very important point, that there are Republican bills. I'm not saying that the bills that were blocked are perfect, but this is what the Senate does. It's supposed to be a deliberative body. It's supposed to debate. It's supposed to amend, right, and work something out. And there should be a bipartisan consensus on things like, let's defend America. This country is under attack right now. I don't want to be histrionic, but I mean, that's what we're being told. And we don't even know what the scope of the attacks are. The Senate intelligence report would suggest that it's much wider than we've known before. Now we're getting reports that it's not just the Russians, it's the Iranians. And look, the reality is, even if you're a Republican and you're a Trump loyalist, why do you assume that all of the attacks are simply going to benefit or are going to hurt Democrats? This could turn, the worm could turn rather dramatically around. I mean, the Iranians and the Chinese aren't necessarily going to be boosting Donald Trump. But, you know, this comes back to the, and I guess I was on television earlier this morning and I said, look, pull back a little bit. Think about how this is going to look to history. Imagine a history book of our times where you have this ongoing attack, all of the warnings that were under attack, all of the credible information we have, and yet when push came to shove, neither the president or Congress would lift a finger. It's going to be amazing. I mean, think how many books were written about, did Franklin Delano Roosevelt screw up the warnings about Pearl Harbor? This is in a class all by itself, though, because it's been going on for so long. So how will history explain this abdication of responsibility by Republicans in Congress. Look, I get the fact that they feel they need to kiss up to the president. I get the fact that they're wholly owned subsidiaries. But isn't it that one of the fundamental constitutional obligations of members of Congress of both parties to defend the country against foreign enemies?
Well, Charlie, you just raised actually what is the most cynical explanation for why the Republicans don't want to address this, which is that they think it could help them again, that the Russian interference. Now, I don't know whether that's true. That might be imputing too much motive on their part. I think it probably has more to do with the president. But I do think that history is going to judge the unwillingness, the slowness to engage on this problem. And they may get tagged with that most cynical viewpoint ultimately.
Yeah. If I can just add one thing to that, like a couple of those people you guys just mentioned, you know, Marco Rubio, Lindsey Graham, these are some of the most prominent members of the GOP who have had to eat the most crow over the last couple of years in terms of being, you know, incredibly strident Trump critics early on, you know, when they were running for president, and then you know, doing a total about face, looking very foolish, going beyond sort of just stopping doing those sorts of things to actually active Trump boosterism. And the explanation that's always given is that, you know, these people are trying to, or, you know, making themselves look silly in order to try to warm Trump up to the things that they want to do, you know, their political projects and things like that. And I think what we see in situations like this is a lot of times that just doesn't work. It doesn't work to try to, you know, pay into the bank of Trump loyalty, and that you're going to get interest on that and then make a withdrawal later. It's for Trump, the way he views loyalty is nothing like that. It's not like, oh, you were good to me back then, I'm going to be good to you now. It's just, you're always good to me, and you expect nothing from me, or I destroy you. And that, I mean, we see this sort of thing over and over again. But I do think, I mean, maybe this is, you know, perverse of me, but I do feel like a little jolt of pleasure when I see you know, McConnell and Trump failing to move on a Lindsey Graham bill, even if it's a pretty good bill, because I'm just like, you know, how could you have expected that this would work out better for you than it did? I mean, it's, okay, there's a certain sense of comeuppance.
This, by the way, is peak ever Egger perverseness. I mean, the pleasure. Yeah, well, I mean,
if that's as bad as it gets, Charlie, I mean, come on.
Well, I see they have been willing to buck him on some things. I mean, you have Republicans who've passed bipartisan legislation against our involvement in the war, you know, in Yemen. They've pushed back on other aspects of foreign policy. They pushed back on him on the Russian sanctions, right? So there have been moments when they've carved this out. And, you know, Sarah, you mentioned Lindsey Graham. I mean, Lindsey Graham's actually saying, yeah, we need to do more. I mean, even Lindsey Graham is saying, yeah, this is really a problem. And yet, I guess it is the extent of the sycophancy that's going on here. Hey, by the way,
Charlie,
yes, go on.
Can I just to double down on the cynicism real quick, real fast?
Please, you can't go too far.
You know, one gloss for that, for the Yemen stuff, for the Russia sanctions stuff, is that, you know, Republicans are more willing to sort of buck the official White House line on things that Trump just doesn't care all that much about personally, right? I mean, like the war in Yemen. I mean, come on, the guy doesn't read his daily intelligence briefings. Who knows? He knows what's happening there. I mean, the things that occupy Trump's mind, you know, the idea of a witch hunt, the idea that his 2016 win was not entirely due to his own excellence and his own power. You know, these are things that really, really matter to him. And so I think that's the reason why, especially on things that touch on that, McConnell is unwilling to move things forward. Now, and again, that's a very, very cynical
No,
take.
No. I think that absolutely nails it, Sarah.
No, I totally agree. And if Trump can find Yemen on a map, I'd give you $5,000.
Whoa. You hear that, party people? Everybody out there in TV land.
Sarah's money is safe. It is completely safe. Okay, so if this lasts more than 4 hours, am I supposed to see a doctor? I'm moving on to the next topic. I just... More than 4 hours.
We're ready to hear what the next topic is.
It's my Schadenfreude. It's my Schadenfreude has definitely lasted more than 4 hours. You know, have we talked about grifters yet today, or should we just like say, okay, and now our grifter section of this?
Well, we mentioned Lindsey Graham, but we can keep going.
Maybe that was it, but you know, I mean, we've talked before about Charlie Kirk's Griftopolis, Turning Point USA.
Oh yeah,
you know what a shambolic mess it is. But, I mean, sweet Jesus, what happened yesterday?
Are we talking about the seal? Is the presidential seal what's...
Yes, an audiovisual aide for conservative student group Turning Point USA was fired this week after President Donald Trump, the president of the United States, appeared on a stage in front of a parody image of the presidential seal at its Teen Student Action Summit. It's just too perfect. It's just, I can't. As the president took the stage Tuesday morning before a sea of 1,500 teenage cell phones, a screen behind him showed a fake presidential seal featuring a two-headed eagle, which bore similarity to the state seal of the Russian Federation, clutching a set of, not arrows, but golf clubs in its talons. The seal was visible for a short time before somebody noticed it, I guess. And apparently it had a slogan over in Spanish that what Donald Trump is, what was it, is a plant or a shield, I whatever.
Yeah, something.
This is just too good.
My question about this, about what happened here is, you know, what happened here? Because obviously there's two possibilities. It was a deliberate troll, or it was just sort of, you know, the person was a dunce and accidentally, you know, pulled up the wrong piece of clip art to project on the on the stage. And the former doesn't really feel like a TPUSA sort of thing. I mean, that's sort of like the sort of dorky, sort of flabby resistance-y type, oh, Trump and Russia are in cahoots sort of memery. And it's sort of like the level of sophistication for like a Turning Point USA joke, but you'd think, you know, all the vectors are going in the wrong directions, you know? It's like, so I don't know what happened. I'd be interested to hear an interview with that fired guy, unless he had to sign some sort of
I don't think you'll ever hear an
as
interview.
As people are sometimes, you know, required to do.
Can we talk about that Turning Point USA speech, though, a little bit?
Oh, please. Yes.
It was insane.
So here's the thing. I was on TV at the time, and so they asked me to stay to comment on it, and so they broke, and we listened to a little bit of it. And it's him. So this is not – even Turning Point USA is often like college kids, but this was like 16 and 17-year-olds. Like it was a high school kid, so young kids. And he's up there going, have you ever seen anybody as great as me? Like have you ever seen a victory as amazing as mine? And he's doing this crazy thing. And then he starts going after Ilhan Omar again, you know, on the heels of this whole controversy. But these are kids. And I was – what I reacted to – on TV, which is, I'm not sure, they wanted me to like specifically, I think, talk about, I don't know what he was saying, but my honest reaction was I could just see myself in that room as a 16-year-old or 17-year-old, as a young conservative, and thinking about who would have been talking to me at the time and what they would have been talking about, which would have been values and limited government and the importance of the party's role. I mean, like, it would have been this, they might have told a joke or two because we were kids, but like, they would have been taking their role seriously as mentors of young people to pull them into the party eventually. And there was just none of that. And it feels like there's nothing sadder to me than Donald Trump being in any way put in a position of moral leadership for these young people, for them to think this is what the party's about. This is who the president is. Like, it's one thing for all of us as adults to be grappling with, but just to see that with those kids like cheering for him, it made me sick to my stomach.
Oh, but I'm sure afterwards, Charlie Kirk is going, that was awesome. That was the best speech ever. That was the best speech ever given by an American president. No. It was the best speech ever given in American politics.
Well, I'm sure Trump said that, and Charlie Kirk then retweeted it. Yeah.
And of course, week we're supposed to be concerned about Robert Mueller's state of mind. And this is, I think Jonathan Lass had a great piece about all this. Seriously, there are people who support Donald Trump who watch speeches like the one you just talked about and, you know, apparently immediately just flip over and go, yes, but that Robert Mueller, we need to be concerned about him. Okay, I want to dive into all of this, including this extraordinary audio-visual mashup. Have you seen Devin Nunes and the Sean Hannity Devin Nunes remix?
I have not seen
it.
It
is great. We want to introduce the podcast audience to that. But first, let's hear from our sponsors. Today's podcast is brought to you by the Ultimate Sleep Machine. Look at the world's top tech leaders and high-growth startup CEOs, and I bet you wonder, how in the world they have that kind of inexhaustible energy to do what they do? And the answer might surprise you. The latest trend with top tech leaders is sleep optimization. While most Americans aren't getting the sleep they need, tech founders and CEOs are optimizing their sleep to perform at peak levels every day. The first step, the Pod by 8 Sleep, the ultimate sleep machine. The Pod is the first and only high-tech bed designed to help you achieve peak mind and body performance. So are you looking to sleep deeper? The pod dynamically adjusts the temperature on each side of the bed so you're comfortable all night. Do you want to know your sleep intel? The pod tracks your biometrics while you sleep with no need for wearable technology. Do you want to sleep better? Enjoy personalized programs and coaching designed by experts guiding you towards true sleep fitness. Because the better you sleep, the better you everything. Try the pod for 100 nights, and if you don't love it, we'll refund your purchase and arrange for a free pickup. Only at 8sleep.com/bulwark. Now, they already sold out their first two batches, so they're going fast. For a limited time, get $150 off your purchases. That's $150 off your purchase when you go to 8sleep.com/bulwark. That's EIGHTsleep.com/bulwark. Our sponsor today is NetSuite.com. Look, if you don't know your numbers, you don't know your business. But the problem growing businesses have, the problem that keeps them from knowing their numbers, is their hodgepodge of business systems. They have one system for accounting, another one for sales, another one for inventory, and so on. It's just a big inefficient mess, taking up too much time and too many resources, and that hurts the bottom line. So, introducing NetSuite by Oracle, the business management software that handles every aspect of your business in an easy-to-use cloud platform, giving you the visibility and control you need to grow. With NetSuite, you save time, money, and unneeded headaches by managing all of your sales, finance, accounting, orders, and HR instantly right from your desktop or phone. And that's why NetSuite is the world's number one cloud business system. And right now, NetSuite is offering you valuable insights with a free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits at netsuite.com/bulwark. That's netsuite.com/bulwark to download your free, completely free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits. netsuite.com/bulwark. Okay, so we are back with Sarah Longwell and Andrew Egger. Right before the break, I mentioned one of the low spots of the Mueller hearing, of which there were many. There were some positive ones, and I want to go back to that as well. But The Daily Show put together a little bit of a montage of Devin Nunes's questions, which are I'm sorry to give this away, word for word from a Sean Hannity monologue. And let's play this. You can't see the video, but look it up if you have a chance. Here it is.
Welcome everyone to the last gasp of the Russia collusion conspiracy theory. The Democrats colluded with Russian sorcerer Bruce Orr, whose own wife worked on Fusion GPS funded by the DNC and the Hillary Clinton campaign, obtained a warrant to spy on the Trump campaign. The top FBI investigator and his lover, a simple basically media operation. The conspiracy theory is now dead.
Oh, man. I mean, you knew that Devin Nunes was a clown. But I mean, this was like, it's like ventriloquism. I mean, it's just, okay, so a little bit earlier, Sarah, we started getting into the Robert Mueller, the Robert Mueller testimony. And like a lot of folks, you know, I fell into the trap of talking a lot about the optics. And the consensus is overwhelming that if this was a TV show, it was a failure and it got very, very bad reviews. He was halting. He was uncertain. Certainly did not deliver the kind of sound bites the Democrats thought they needed. People are, you know, using euphemisms like Robert Mueller lost a few steps. And in today's newsletter, I backed off and I said, you know, all of these hot takes really do ignore the fact that there was a lot of substance there. But this is who we are now, right? We do judge life like it's a reality show. And this man delivers this 450-page report with this devastating detail of the mendacity of the president of the United States. And here we are in our trivial moment, and all we can focus on is he looked a little bit doddery, and I mentioned how things are going to look to history. I don't think that our hot takes are going to look good to history. Again, people are going to look back on all of the evidence that was presented, all of the issues. There'll be more information, and then there will be that question: what the hell was going on in July of 2019? And the answer will be: people were focused on the television show.
So I mentioned very early on that that I had woken up feeling fresh after the day after the Mueller report, and I will say that it was that did not last particularly long. Within a couple of hours, I was back to my my ordinary despairing
us.
Cynical self, and the reason was all these hot takes and the wildest thing to me is yes, I mean even going into the hearing, we streamed here at the Bulwark office. We streamed the hearing from MSNBC because we're cucks, and the commentators going in, I remember the guy, the last thing they said as they're panning to the committee room is now Mueller's gonna come in and he's gonna have to decide whether he's gonna answer the call of history and basically spill the beans or whether he's not gonna do that. And obviously obviously if those are your expectations going into the hearing, that Robert Mueller is finally going to deliver you your Trump knockout punch, such that Democrats in Congress or wherever don't have to do anything about Trump. Trump just shrivels up under the weight of Robert Mueller's charismatic, amazing testimony and sort of self-immolates or, performs a citizen's arrest on himself or something like that. I mean, it's insane stuff. So obviously, if you go into the hearing with expectations like that, your expectations are going to be dashed a little bit. But the thing that was so wild to me was how many Republicans and people in conservative media were also apparently going into the expectation or going into the hearing with the expectation that Mueller was going to try really hard. Like now's the moment where Mueller's going to try to get Trump. And then when he doesn't try to get Trump and doesn't get Trump, obviously Trump's still around. He was always going to be still around. Then everybody's like looking around and they're like, well, clearly Mueller failed in some way. But it just makes me want to like chew drywall to read all of these takes, because Mueller clearly did not particularly go in there with the great desire to spill new beans, to do more. Hashtag resistance work against the president, and yet everybody, it seems like on both sides has now imbibed the notion that because he didn't do that, he somehow failed. And
well, you wrote a very thoughtful piece the day after that this was the Robert Mueller that we needed, and you had a really sort of a contrarian take on this because everybody else was dragging him for his performance.
Well, I just don't get why it was a contrarian take, because I don't get why it had to be. Because he was going in and he said early on that he was not going to go beyond the four corners of his own report. It was a pretty big, exhaustive report. And that was what you just saw for the entirety of the thing. He was so careful, he was so precise, and to the point where a lot of the things that he was doing in order to just make sure that he didn't say anything that was outside the confines of the report, these are the very things he's now being knocked for. I mean, people are all over conservative media speculating, or more than speculating, basically stating as though it's positive fact that Mueller displayed like an ignorance of his own report by just any time somebody read him something, he would ask, is that in the report? Can you give me the citation? Just making sure that the only facts he was interacting with were facts that he had already positively put out there. And I think sorry to ramble on, but just one other thing like that's sort of missing from this, Robert Mueller has more information even now than the public has. Only what was in his report was released, and even only a redacted version of that. So it totally makes sense, at least to my way of thinking, that when he comes into this hearing and is asked a whole lot of extemporaneous questions, one of his overriding concerns, even before anything else, is just making sure that he is only trafficking in that information which is already public. It's so goofy. I hate it. Really made me kind of mad.
But we all know Sarah. And Sarah, you always are rooting for the knockout punch, aren't you?
Am I personally?
Look, yeah, you wanted a knockout punch.
No.
We all wanted a knockout punch.
Okay,
come on.
Listen. All right. Would it have been amazing if Robert Mueller had said, but for the DOL opinion, Donald Trump would have been indicted? Like, that was basically the moment that the Democrats really kind of needed that would have actually like changed, I think, things from their really entrenched positions. It would have had to go there. But I agree with Andrew, like, it was never going to go there. He was never going to say that. But do I crave the distilled easy to understandable, no double negatives in the things. Do I just that level of truth just in clear English that the American public could understand? So we're all working off the same set of facts. Yeah, I crave that. At the same time, in a world where nobody is serious and nobody is neutral, to have a person who is of unimpeachable integrity give a totally apolitical, performance, and it wasn't even a performance, be totally restrained, adhere assiduously to the idea that he should not interfere with anything that is ongoing, and that you couldn't detect a political bone in his body. The only thing he was animated around at all was the desperate need to defend America from these attacks from foreign adversaries. There is just a part of me that admires him so much and just is disgusted with all the rest of us.
This really is an indictment of us in our times, though, isn't it? I mean, the way you describe it.
Well, what you're getting at there, Sarah, is I think the kernel of why we are now being barraged with all of these, Mueller is a doddering, senile old fool takes, because there's a political necessity for it now that Mueller has come up and sat before these committees and just so sort of deliberately and assiduously declined to do that exact thing that you're saying. And the reason, the reason why he declined to do that, he lays it out in his report. He basically says it would be, and he says it in hypothetical terms, and so you can take it with a grain of salt. But basically, it would be unjust for him and his team to come out and say, but for this OLC opinion, he would be charged, because you can't positively state that the president has committed a crime as a prosecutor without allowing him sort of the opportunity to redress that in court. I mean, that's from the opinion. But so what we've seen from a lot of these takesters in conservative media and Trump world is Mueller has to be sort of doddering and not all there, because that allows sort of the angry Democrats who are underneath him, Andrew Weissman and all these other people who have been built up as villains of Trump world. Now they're the ones who are actually running the show, according to the narrative, because clearly Mueller doesn't have anti-Trump animus, or he could have, injected some of that into his performance. You have to amend the narrative a little bit.
I was going to save this for later, but I think the segue is too obvious now. So who had the worst take? What was the worst take?
I wonder if we'll all agree on this. Yeah, but Byron York. So. Oh. Byron York had the worst take. Because
he knows better.
I don't even know if Mueller was done testifying when the take came out, but it was one of these like, brutal. Maybe it's time that we all grapple with the idea that, Mueller is senile. and the thing is like, yeah, just if you think about how much he had to hold in his head, and look, hey, I have eyes. I watched it too. Okay. Do I wish that he had been had sort of cut a shape or projected something that gave the American people like unending confidence in everything that he says? Sure, I wish that. But like the idea that these, to coin a JVL term, the Trump humpers who say that, everything that Trump does is brilliant and he's playing four-dimensional chess, and a guy like Robert Mueller is senile. Like, that's all you need to know about how serious a person is with a take like that.
Right. And it's, The cult of personality thing that has been built up around Mueller. I mean, it's clearly that sort of thing. Like Mueller, like a shirtless, ripped Mueller wearing a cape. That sort of thing is goofy, and it's always been goofy. But it doesn't really have anything to do with the work that Mueller did, which is not about sort of overwhelming personality and charisma and just being like the kind of figure that America can really like feel awesome about. It's just sort of about being kind of conscientious and careful and diligent and doing the work. And that's, there was absolutely nothing in the hearing to suggest that he was, unsatisfactory in any of those ways at any point in the past 2 years.
Yeah, so in terms of worst takes, the Federalist is always up there. Dinesh D'Souza is always up there. He said, is it possible the Republicans have kidnapped the real Robert Mueller and substituted a mentally retarded lookalike in his place? Nice. Really classy. Okay, so you're also getting into where I wanted to go next. Is like, okay, let's everything that we've said, about. Sorry, let me interrupt myself before we do this. His performance was not great. But on the other hand, I wonder how any other normal human being would react to that kind, the 5-minute speed talking, where were you on, January 21st, 1927, and before you can turn to the page, even the Democrats, when they were asking him, like, he would say, where's the citation? And the Democrats would move on. They were not interested in hearing his answers. And so for somebody who is trying to be careful, this was the worst possible format because he is trying assiduously to stay within the four corners. He was, under that DOJ, under the DOJ guidelines. And the speed of the questions and the bad faith of the questions and the fact that no one wanted to give him a chance to even look up what the references were, I think that most people would look a little bit dottery under those circumstances. But having said that and possibly rationalizing there, the point you were getting at, Andrew, we had built him up. We talk about the cult of personality. To a certain extent, Democrats, I think, and Trump skeptics in general, I think maybe put too much weight on Robert Mueller, that they wanted Robert Mueller to do everybody else's work for us. The Democrats in Congress, sat there and they twiddled their thumbs because Mueller was going to come and Mueller's report was going to do this. Well, then Mueller's testimony was going to do this. There was a flaw in building the expectations up way beyond what was justified.
Yeah, I'm not trying to be, Robert Mueller's biggest cheerleader here, but I don't think I necessarily agree that he wasn't that great up there. I mean, he wasn't supposed to be particularly great, in my opinion. I mean, like the thing I wrote in my piece from yesterday was that, it was the goal of everybody on that committee, Democrats and Republicans alike, to try to extract some sort of like new news out of Robert Mueller, some sort of, new revelations about anything, really. But, from Mueller's perspective, he'd given everything he wanted to give to Congress, to the American people, to them in the form of his report. And so his sort of overarching concern was just to not break more news, to speak for his report, to allow his report to speak for itself. I mean, essentially.
But in fact, his testimony was substantive, and this is why I sort of was kind of cringing at that I fell into the whole optics thing. And I quoted James Holman from the Washington Post about this. I mean, there were some, pretty good sound bites there. When he talks about the Russian interference in domestic politics, they're doing it as we sit here. They expect to do it in the next campaign. When he was asked about Trump's praise of WikiLeaks, he says it's problematic is an understatement in terms of what it displays of giving some hope or some boost to what is and should be illegal behavior. Ooh, that was pretty tough. Rebutting Trump's claim of total exoneration. I mean, that was in the first, minute of the entire testimony. It felt like the president was not exculpated for the acts that he allegedly committed. He defended the integrity of the investigation. It is not a witch hunt. When he's describing why he didn't subpoena the president, we decided we didn't want to exercise the subpoena's power because of the necessity of expediting the end of the investigation, which of course pushes back on the president's complaints that they were dragging it all about. And then really, we talk about that. In fact, there was a cover up here. Number of people we interviewed in our investigation, it turns out, did lie. And so you separate, and this is why I think the history is going to look at this. They're going to look at that transcript and say, look, this was right in front of you. You saw this. There's no excuse for members of Congress and the public not to know what this investigation found and what he said. And yet, here we are. It's a television show. The Democrats are responding to this by saying, yeah, we're not going to go ahead with impeachment. They now have just left Washington, D.C. for a 6-week vacation. And already the attention is turned to the Democratic debates next week, where we can expect it to be another circular firing squad. I mean, it was funny. I took the dog out for a walk yesterday, and they were already talking about, well, who's going to attack Biden? How hard are they going to attack Biden? How many different directions? Is Joe Biden, done or not? It looks like, by the way, Joe Biden's staging kind of a comeback here, that one debate did not derail him.
I'm not sure that he was ever really out. But it's funny. I mean, just before I walked in here, despite the fact that I don't follow him, I still saw that Trump was tweeting that how dare Fox News, publish a poll that showed that Joe Biden, Sleepy Joe, was besting him by 9 or 10 points. And I think it speaks to the fact that regardless of whether, the busing hit landed for a brief moment, that ultimately, there's staying power to Joe Biden while the other people kind of move up and down with 2 points or 3 points. Joe Biden has consistently stayed up there on top, and I'm not sure he's going to be as easy to get rid of. If his numbers keep doing like that, it's self-reinforcing, the idea that he's the one who could – because if you look at him, you know, Warren is probably the only person who's really on the move and maybe that I would say really has a chance to overcome him in the end because she's running a nice steady campaign. But her numbers head-to-head are not good, and I'm not sure she's either up by 1 point or down by 1 point, but in any event – the Democrats at some point are going to say, look, if this guy, if Joe Biden's beating him by 9 or 10 points in every single poll, that's got to be our guy.
Can I just read that and Trump Ohio tweet that too. You that you mentioned a minute ago? Because it's so good. I hadn't seen it yet. Here it is. Fox News is at it again. So different from what they used to be during the 2016 primaries and before. Proud warriors. Now new Fox polls, which have always been terrible to me, they had me losing big to Crooked Hillary, have me down to Sleepy Joe. Even considering the fact that I have gone through a 3-year vicious witch hunt, it's two tweets, perpetrated by the lamestream media in collusion with Crooked and the Democratic Party, there can be no way with the greatest economy in U.S. history that I can be losing to the sleepy one. Keep America great. Those are good tweets. I'm sorry.
Those are good.
Insane content. Great content. I mean,
the lamestream media.
And the sleepy one. I enjoy that a lot. But yeah. Okay, can I also say just one quick thing
about
the Democratic primaries.
Yeah, right.
One thing that I find a little bit silly about all of these, you know, the armchair punditry about how the debates go, how they're going to go. Most of it is sort of like attributing like a lot of agency to these candidates, which is fair because they're the actors, they're the players. But I do think we're still in the early enough going that if there's if Biden is going to bleed, you know, to some of these other people, it's not necessarily going to be through any particular gaffe, through any particular, you know, bussing moment with Kamala Harris or anything like that. It's just, you know, the people who are. It's just going to be more and more new people, you know, new people showing up and starting to pay attention as we get closer and closer to the election. And I think Biden is benefiting a little bit now in polling from the fact that, you know, he has the highest name recognition out there and all those sorts of things. So as people learn, you know, more and more about the different candidates, it's going to be Biden's task to prevent them from jumping ship.
Can I go someplace, like kind of an awkward place here? Is it okay? It's a podcast.
Take it awkward, man.
Okay, so I'm connecting the dots with what happened with Robert Mueller. Not to relitigate that, okay? And people are going, whoa, Robert Mueller, he's 74 years old. Seemed really old, okay? So now are people going to be looking at Joe Biden going, are we going to look for that sort of thing? Because the last thing Democrats want is to go into 2020 with, you know, an old guy who's going to turn in a debate performance that is, shall we say, subpar, because as much as we don't want things to be about optics, and we know presidential politics are all about optics, right? So I would think that there's, well, let me ask you, I mean, I think there's going to be extra pressure on Grandpa Joe, who's, what, he's about 106, right? to see whether he's going to have senior moments or whether he's going to come off as vigorous. And in fact, I think that may be actually more important than the specifics of what he says.
Yeah, I mean, that very well could be. I don't know. I mean, hasn't Biden always had sort of like kind of crazy old man energy to him? I mean, that's sort of his brand, you know, just sort of like the back slapping and the geniality and sort of like the slight benevolent racism and all those sorts of things.
That's fair.
It's a little bit of his brand. I mean, it's unlike Mueller insofar as Mueller is supposed to just be like this unstoppable force, you know, like the Terminator or something like that. And he showed up and was an old guy.
It was more rattling to see.
Yeah, it was a little more jarring.
The armory ranger doing it than opposed to crazy Joe Biden. Now, one of my hot takes from the earlier debates that nobody picked up on, I literally never saw anybody agree with me on this one, was that I thought Biden benefited by being right next to Bernie Sanders, because then Bernie Sanders controlled the, you know, old man yelling at clouds lane. You know?
Yeah, I will just say that I the boomers cannot get out of the way soon enough for me. Like watching Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump and Joe Biden and even a little bit, you know, Mueller yesterday, it is just clear that people who are in their mid-70s, you know, are not as sharp as they need to be to kind of be in the arena. And it's like when Donald Trump's up there in front of Turning Point USA rambling on about how Article 2 gives him all the powers that exist in the world.
I can do anything.
Like,
I'm the president. I can do what I want.
Yeah. And like, I don't, I mean, we can debate Joe Biden's age, I guess, but what is he going to be, 2 years older than Trump? Like, they're all roughly the same age, and all of it is too old.
Yeah, exactly. There's this thing about politics and the law where is there any place else in the world where our institutions are dominate, well, besides, I suppose, the Catholic Church, are dominated by people in their 80s and their 70s and 80s. I mean, this is the – most people at that age are like, hey, enjoy your grandkids. Do something. You know, go to
– That's not – it's not it anymore,
move
though.
To
now
Miami,
people that age, you know? Now people that age are glued to the TV. They are as – they are the angriest of the demographic populations. They vote more than the I mean, one of the reasons that these old guys to some degree are all – you know, still doing really well is that the fact is the voters are 65 plus and they don't think to them Joe Biden doesn't look that old.
Well, and he's had a lot of Botox, which also helps.
And he wears aviators.
I have to say he doesn't look as old to me as I thought he would. Although I wish he didn't have the Botox thing. I don't think that's helpful. You know, there is that little, you know, shock. And again, here we are. See, I'm the one who's dragging us down back to the optics. You know, you look at the old pictures of Joe Biden. I thought he looked fine, you know, and somebody said, hey, you got to lose, you know, 20 pounds and go Botox, and it's like, I don't know that's the right thing to do.
Yeah, but Charlie, I mean, everybody always says that about, you know, people after plastic surgery. It's like, oh, I don't know. I mean, like, but then, you know, if you can imagine, you know, what a mid-70s Joe Biden would look like without, I mean, there's a reason people keep getting plastic surgery. You'd be like, no, go back.
Do it one time. No, I see. But you made an interesting point before about expectations. You know, Donald Trump's at the point now where he could stand up in front of a group of teenagers and say, hey, under Article 2, I can do anything. And, you know, he could, like, you know, take off all his clothes and run around and everything, you know, and just, you know.
He could weirdly hug a flag.
howl at the moon. And you know, commentators would go, well, you know, the president is finding a different way to appeal to his base. And, you know, people would go, well, you know, at least
it's not. And we'd have this super tiring centrist like commentary on the commentary, like, oh, are we actually helping Donald Trump by calling attention to how crazy he is and all that nonsense.
Well, and then there's Ilhan Omar, right? He would just go, well, what about? I mean, there is really pretty much nothing that he can do that people are going to go, whoa, dude, this guy's crazy. Right. I mean, it's like that's baked in. So you're saying that Biden benefits a little bit from that. So I think that is true. I'm just hoping that the Democrats do not get caught up in the let's eat our own thing next week. Of course, that's a vain thought. But also I keep hearing, because I'm on MSNBC a lot, there's this belief in the myth of the pivot. That, yes, you can say all kinds of crazy left-wing things during the primary, but don't worry, you can pivot back in the general election. Like what? It's like, you know, this is the campaign of, you know, 1948 or something like that, that there's not YouTube videos and permanent images and sound bites of every freaking thing that they're saying.
Right, like Elizabeth Warren will tack to the center and we'll all be like, oh, you know what? She actually does seem like a reasonable centrist. I forgot about that time that she said, let's abolish private health insurance.
Right, right.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like,
except $1 billion worth of ads will be reminding you of that.
But here's the thing. And I buy this. Like, I think you guys are correct. But I also sort of wonder, I mean, these people could tack to the center, you know, until the cows come home. For the next year solid, they could do nothing but talk about, you know, means-tested welfare and the importance of, you know, Medicare for all who want it and all those sorts of things. And Donald Trump is still going to get up on the debates and call them all communists and, you know, twist like some half-remembered thing they said one time into saying that they're calling for the death of all white people. And it's just, I mean, that's going to happen. So, I mean, it's an open question as far as I'm concerned.
But it matters whether it's true or not.
That's right.
It does matter.
Absolutely. So I'm going to fight with you on this because this is what Republicans say about racism. Mm-hmm, they're like, mm-hmm. Oh, well, the left is going to accuse us of racism no matter what. And it's like, okay, but that's not an excuse to actually be racist.
Oh, yeah. No. Absolutely. I'm not doing any prescription here at all. I'm just talking about the likelihood of it actually helping her.
But that's what they're telling one another. They're saying, look, Mayor Pete even said something like, well, they're going to accuse us of being socialists, so no matter what we do, so we might as well go big. Well, wait, you know? There's a big difference between Donald Trump saying, you're for open borders and you want to give free health care to illegal immigrants, versus Democrats going, yeah, we're for open borders and we really do want to have free health care for illegal immigrants. Well, okay. I remember that moment where Ronald Reagan in the debate, I think it was Jimmy Carter, or maybe it was Walter Mondale. See, now I forget these things. It's, you know, on onset of Alzheimer's, where he goes, he was accused of something, and he goes, well, there you go again. There you go again. And it was one of those little grace moments where he just made the charge seem silly. And instead of reinforcing his radicalism, instead of forcing the radicalism of the Democrat against Trump, maybe it'll reinforce the fact that this guy is just full of shit all the time, and he makes stuff up, and he lies all the time. So I do think it matters, you know, what the truth is, because
yeah, they shouldn't give him this talking point. They should not let him have this, and they should be able to say, maybe AOC over there, this first-term congresswoman, which, by the way, a first-term congresswoman, not the same as the sitting president in relevance to a political party.
Right.
So, I mean, they should be trying to, not walk into his trap. I don't understand it.
Yeah, some of them are, and the ones who are not getting very much traction the only thing.
And in terms of pivot, the only two, well, not only two, I mean, two of them that are not going to be able to pivot. I don't think Warren can pivot. I don't think that Bernie Sanders can pivot. Kamala Harris might be able to, because she's shown an ability to take, you know, 10 different positions on an issue. And there are other, you know, moderates who have no chance whatsoever, like Amy Klobuchar, who I think would be a solid nominee. Okay.
Hickenlooper, Bennett, all those guys.
Yeah, who are no hopers. Okay, no one cares about this. No one listening to this podcast cares about this, because we know
this,
right?
Turn this podcast off
You could do it. So and Andrew Egger, you know, we just passed a new spending bill that will add $300 billion to spending. It completely blows up the sequester. Fiscal conservatism has been blown up, and we now have $1 trillion a year deficits because, right, nobody ever lost an election by spending money, and all that stuff about the debt and deficits. What? Nobody cares.
Yes. Right? You might have already talked about this on the podcast recently. Rush Limbaugh, anybody?
It never mattered.
Yeah. and now he treats fiscal responsibility as though that were only a thing that, like, you know, Beltway insiders ever cared about or anything like that. That was an establishment GOP thing
to worry about
the deficit. Yeah, right. One thing about this, and yes, we did just pass this enormous bipartisan gigantic deficit spending bill. I have to give some props to my friend Thomas Massey. He's not really my friend. He's a congressman. But he proposed an amendment and forced a vote on the House floor about it, to rename the budget bill a bill to kick the can down the road and for other purposes. And they had a vote on it, and only 47 people voted for it. But I would have voted for it, Thomas, if I were in Congress. So
it was kind of a free
shout out to you.
It was kind of a free vote, and yet they can't do it.
If it had passed, that would have been kind of embarrassing.
Yes, but it would have been a moment of truth telling. It would have been kind of refreshing, right?
You know what this is, Charlie? It's the end of the Tea Party. It's the stake through the heart.
Absolutely.
It's the last gasp. An entire movement dead in 9 years.
Yeah.
Well, and what I sort of wonder about that is, I was a child when the Tea Party was first getting off the ground, and it generated an enormous amount of enthusiasm, and I had friends who had Tea Party shirts, and I never got to go to a rally, so I never got a shirt. But and there was just like an enormous amount of excitement about it, and it was all about, at least for the people I was around, all about sort of this return to, you know, the principles of the founders and fiscal responsibility and passing down the country for your children and all those sorts of things. But there was also sort of an enormous amount of media energy basically trying to say the Tea Party was all based on sort of racial resentments and you know, hatred of the first black president and all those sorts of things. And it's hard not to look at sort of like the progression from there to here and just see like a lot of people who either, you know, those things were true about them at the time, or, you know, a critical mass of people who, you know, heard those attacks for years and years and years and honestly got sort of so cynical and fed up about them that they are now sort of playing down to those impulses, because the thing that has survived from then has not been, you know, the concern for fiscal responsibility and founding principles and all those sorts of things.
Okay.
It's been the sort of resentments and class.
Yeah, I'm still like stuck that. On Andrew saying that he was such a child during the Tea Party.
Well, so I was an old child.
I was a child when John F. Kennedy was assassinated and the Great Society was being passed.
I was in high school.
We're not going to ask Sarah. We'll give you a pass. Sarah and Andrew, thank you so much for joining me on this weekend mega podcast. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Charlie.
And I'm going to be off next week, so we're going to have guest hosts on the podcast. So make sure you check that out. And today's podcast was brought to you by NetSuite and by 8Sleep. Check them out. Thanks for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. We'll be back next week, and we'll do this all over again.